Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is March the 21st. Nissan, is it Hey Nissan? Depends on how dark it is. Okay. And we're in Melachim Beis, Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17. We're up to Pasuk Chav Tes 29. Let's just get our bearings here. So the Sanherev, when he took the 10 tribes into exile, he then replaced them with all types of different nations, including those from who are called Kusim. They're from Kus, and they're called Kusim. And the name of these people has become known as the Kusim. And they practiced their regular paganism over there in Eretz Yisrael, and Hashem brought against them lions. So they were being destroyed by the lions. They were being mauled and killed. And it was obviously a plague. There was no way to avoid that. Even Sanherev recognized that. Therefore, Sanherev authorized that one of the Kohanim from Shomron should return to Eretz Yisrael to teach the Kusim how to behave in a manner that Hashem would not bring lions against them. So, and that is what he did. And that's what we're up to, that he showed them how to behave. But unfortunately, since the only way he knew how to behave was inappropriately, which means that to straddle the fence, to be worshiping Hashem, but at the same time also performing Avodah Zarah, so that's what he taught them to do. So Pasuk Chav Tes, verse 29, Vayosim goy goy Elohav, each nation would do their deity, their god. Vayanichu beveis habamos, asher asu ha-shomronim, they left in the houses of the altars that which the Shomronim did. Goy goy b'areim, each nation in their cities. Asher heim yoshvim sham, that they dwell there. So we're going to get a description now of what they did, of what their gods were. V'anshei Bavel asu es sukos benos, the people from Bavel, they made their paganism, which is called sukos benos, which is a form of worship of hens with their chicks. That was the idol that they worshipped. V'anshei Chus asu es nergol, the people of Chus made Nergol, which is a rooster. V'anshei Chamas asu es Ashima, they did Ashima, which is a goat. V'ha'avim asu Nivchaz, they did Nivchaz, which is a dog. V'es Tartak, which is a donkey. V'ha'svarvim, and what about the Svarvim? Well, they were Sarfim es B'neim Ba'esh, they burned their children in fire. Le'adram Melech v'ana Melech Elohei Sifarvoyim, to Adar Melech, which looks like a mule, and Anamelech, which looks like a horse, the gods of Sfarvoyim. So we get a detailed description of their paganism. Vayu Yoreim es Hashem, they feared Hashem. Vayasu Lahem Miktsosam Kohanei Vamos, and they made from some of them Kohanim of the Bamos, meaning those Bamos that they would offer sacrifices to Hashem himself. Vayosim lahem beveis habamos, they would make for them in the beis habamos. Now that word miktsosam, from part of them, they would make into Kohanim. We're going to talk about that presently. Es Hashem hayu yireim, they feared Hashem. Ves Elohim hayu avdim, but they served their gods. Sounds like that shouldn't be possible, but they did it anyway. Like the same way, like the nations that they were exiled from there. Until this day, they do like these original ways of behavior. They do not fear Hashem, which is in contrast to what we said before, they do fear Hashem. They do not do according to their laws and the rules, and as they don't follow the Torah, v'chator v'chamitzvah, asher tivah Hashem esbnei Yaakov, asher esam shmo Yisrael, that Hashem had commanded the children of Yaakov that He made His name Yisrael, they do not follow the laws of the Torah. So in Pasuk Lamed Gimel in 33, where it says, as Hashem hayu yireim, they had fear of Hashem. In Pasuk Lamed Dal 34, where it says, Einam yireim as Hashem, they don't fear Hashem, that means they did not keep the Torah properly. It's true they had some fear of Hashem because of the lions, and because of that, they did have some worship to Hashem going on, but it was not real because they didn't really fear Hashem, and they served their own paganism, their own deities, and they did not serve Hashem properly. So here, the Navi now goes into a paragraph about what Hashem, the covenant that Hashem had originally made with the Bnei Yaakov, that Hashem made His name Yisrael. Pasuk Lamed Hey, Vayikros Hashem Itam Bris, Hashem had made a covenant with them, meaning with the Jewish people. Vayetzavein Lemor, He commanded them, saying, Lo Siru Elohim Achirim, do not fear other gods. Velos Yishtachavu Lahem, do not bow down to them. Velos Avdum, don't serve them. Velos Sizbechu Lahem, do not offer sacrifices to them. Ki Emes Hashem Asher Ha'elo Eschem Eretz Mitzrayim, only Hashem that brought you up from the land of Egypt. Bechoach Gadol Bizron Atuya, with great strength and an outstretched arm. O so Siro, He you should fear. Velos Yishtachavu, Velos Sizbechu, you should not bow, meaning to other gods, and you should not sacrifice to other gods. Ves haChukim, ves haMishpatim, veHaTorah, veHaMitzvah, asher kasav lochem, and the laws, the statutes, the Torah, the Mitzvah that He wrote for you, tishmenun laasos, you shall guard to do, kol hayomim, all the days, velo siru Elohim acharim, do not fear other gods. This is all when Hashem had commanded the Jews. Veabris asher karati itchem lo sishkachu, the covenant I made with you, you should not forget. Velo siru Elohim acharim, do not fear other gods. Ki emes Hashem Elokechem tiro, rather only Hashem your God you should fear. For hu yatzil eschem yad kol avechem, He will save you from all your enemies. Velo shameu, they didn't listen. Ki im kimishpatam harishon himosim, they did according to their what they used to do, their old ways that they worshipped other gods. Vayu agoyim ha'ela, these nations that were now here in Shomron, yireim es Hashem, again, there's the going back to they did fear Hashem, sort of. Ves pesileim ha'yu ovdim, and they still worshipped their idols. Gam b'neim uvnei b'neim, also their children and their grandchildren, kasher asu avosam hemosim, as their fathers did, so they do. Ad hayom hazeh, until this day, they did not actually accept Hashem. There is a great debate in the Gemara whether the Kusim are Geirei Emes, are they true converts, or are they Geirei Arayos, or are they the converts of lions? Meaning, we know that they converted because of the lions. So does that make them true converts, or are they not true converts? Now this, we have to really explain the whole concept of converting for an ulterior motive in order to understand this. But this is debated in the Gemara. Before we get into all the details, let's understand that these are the Shomronim, non-Jews who were brought to Israel and made to dwell in the place where the 10 tribes used to be. They are known to the Christian world as Samaritans. And today in Israel, there still are people who claim to be descendants of the Samaritans and hold themselves to be Samaritans. At one point in time, there were Shomronim, there were allegedly over a million adherents to what the Shomronim believed in, which we'll talk about. That number dwindled throughout the years. There was always great friction between, we'll call them, real Jews and the Shomronim, and eventually there was a account made of the Shomronim when Israel became a state and earlier in the 20th century, and there were very, very few remaining. Today, again, they still exist. There are people who claim to be from the Kusim. Now, in order to understand this question of, we're going back nearly 3,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago. We're going back a long way. So in order to understand at that point in time whether they were really Jewish or not, so first let's understand what does it mean to convert for an ulterior motive. The halacha is that we do not accept a convert if the reason for the conversion is an ulterior motive. So the most common ulterior motive, of course,
is
a woman converting for a man or a man converting for a woman. That is the most common ulterior motive, but there can be others. There are other ulterior motives that can be there. There could be potential jobs. Today, in our day and age, the reason why we have to be very careful with accepting converts is because we are very attractive because we have community, and community doesn't exist anywhere. Almost anywhere else in the world, we are the only ones really who have community, which is very, very attractive to people. People who are floating, people don't have much, and it's so attractive to know that you have groups of people that are going to have your back and are going to watch out for you. And you know that it's a wonderful thing that we have, but that's also very attractive, and therefore we have to make sure that a convert is sincere. So, in the days of Shlomo HaMelech, they did not accept converts. Converts were not, you could not convert in the days of Shlomo HaMelech, at least not, quote-unquote, legally. Not with the sanction of the based in of the Sanhedrin. They would not allow it. Because in the days of Shlomo HaMelech, we ruled the world. We were on top of the world. We were the center of the world economically, militarily, everything. Culturally, we were the center of the world. So, cool, who didn't want to be Jewish? Whereas a non-Jew who came forward in 1850 and wanted to convert in Eastern Europe, so either he was clinically insane or he was sincere, right? So who wanted to be Jewish in those days? So right, today we are far better than 1850 Eastern Europe, but we're not at the point of Shlomo HaMelech. So we have to be careful with it, but we do accept converts. So that is the halacha. So if somebody comes and wants to convert, we have to, it says in Shulchan Aruch, it says in the Rambam, you have to find out, you have to do some investigation and make sure that they're not coming for an ulterior purpose. That's the first thing you have to do. Now, in the event that someone is trying to convert for an ulterior reason, we're not supposed to accept them. And that's why in the days of Shlomo Melech, they didn't accept converts. However, the halacha is, although it's debated, we paskin kulam gerim. They are all converts, which means if someone does convert for an ulterior purpose, a man converts because he wants to marry a Jewish woman, that's why he converts. Openly, he says that's why he's converting. But the halacha is, even though we should not accept him, however, if he goes through the process and a Beis Din does convert him, he is a convert. The conversion works, even though it was for an ulterior motive. That's how we paskin. We rule kulam gerim. It does work. Even in the days
so
of
Shlomo... Why would a Beis Din convert him?
Correct. So even in the days of Shlomo HaMelech, the Rambam writes that even though the Sanhedrin did not accept gerim, but there were still individuals throughout the country who were well-meaning and converted people. And lots of people converted in the days of Shlomo HaMelech, even though it was not an appropriate thing to do that. But it happened. And you can understand how it would happen. You have people and someone comes forward and you feel bad and it's, oh, you know, this person, I'm sure he's sincere. You know? And since a Beis Din is simply three Jewish men who are over bar mitzvah, who are not related to each other, who are somewhat learned, they do not have to be huge Talmidei Chachamim, they have to be somewhat learned, that is an acceptable Beis Din. Now, we all know, you and I would never go to such a Beis Din to get our financial matters resolved, because we would say, what do they know? So we wouldn't rely on them for that. But if someone wants to convert and the Sanhedrin is not going to accept him, he'll gladly go to three hediotos, to three not such great Talmidei Chachamim, in order to find a way of converting. So as long as the Beis Din is a kosher Beis Din, and they go through the process properly, the process for men and women is that they have to go to the mikvah, and they have to accept mitzvos upon themselves. A man also has to go through bris milah. That's an additional step for a man. So, assuming that it is done properly, then the conversion works. The only reason why a conservative or reform conversion does not work and the people are not Jewish is not because they didn't go through the process of milah and mikvah and accepting mitzvos. That's not the issue. The reason is because the Beis Din is not a kosher Beis Din. Because if the people are not keeping the Torah, if the Beis Din is not keeping the Torah, they are an invalid Beis Din. And that's why non-Orthodox conversions don't work, because the people are not keeping the Torah. So, but assuming they do keep the Torah, now you could argue, if they keep the Torah, why they're not listening to the Sanhedrin? Okay, that's a good argument, but they're not flagrantly violating the Torah. They're not trying to be bad people. They're well-meaning, and they're trying to convert people that they think should be converted. So, therefore, we paskin that the gerus does work. The gerus does work. Now, as an aside, there are Orthodox conversions that are called into question. Because what does it mean to keep the Torah? See, when you say three adult male Jews who keep the Torah, but what does it mean to keep the Torah? No one is perfect. Even the greatest Talmidei Chacham are not perfect. So keeping the Torah clearly does not mean a person never does an Aveira. But it would seem to mean at least that the person tries to keep the entire Torah. So what if you have a person who is sitting on a Beis Din who keeps Shabbos, at least as well as they know how to keep Shabbos, they keep Shabbos, and keeps kosher, and keeps Taharas HaMishpacha, family purity, but they are regular speakers of Lashon Hara, with no regard for the laws of Lashon Hara. Does that make the person invalid to sit on the Beis Din? I don't know, right? Or what if they do not fast during the rabbinic fasts? They don't fast on Tisha B'Av. So does that make the person not kosher to be in a Beis Din? So you see that things can get a little bit fuzzy over who's kosher to be in a Beis Din and who's not. So that's why sometimes you have people going through an Orthodox conversion, quote-unquote Orthodox conversion, where even their conversion is called into question, which is, today we're in a stage where that goes on, and here, Israel, this becomes a very funny kind of situation where you don't know for certain. Yeah?
Let's say someone keeps all the Torah, okay, as much as we can know, but yet, the people that they're converting one after another stops keeping it after the conversion.
Okay.
Like, is then the process called into question?
So that's a good question. That's what we're going to get into over here.
Okay.
So let's talk about now a person who converts, and let's assume the Beis Din is impeccable. I don't know if today we have such a thing, but let's assume the Beis Din is impeccable. It's the Sanhedrin converted them, and the person is, and they went through the process. And they keep the Torah, and then 6 months later, they're eating pork. So what's the halacha? Does that mean that the conversion was no good? So we presume, as a default, the conversion is good, it was good, and the person couldn't hack it. After a while, they it's difficult to give up pork, and he likes pork, and he couldn't handle it. And you know, so he gave it up. He gave up. But he's a Jew now who went off the derech. That is one of the reasons why we have to be very careful that a convert is sincere. It's bad enough when a Jew who's born Jewish doesn't keep the Torah. To bring in more people who aren't going to keep the Torah, that doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help us, it doesn't help them, it doesn't help the world. Bringing in people who are going to be sincere and are going to keep the Torah sincerely, that helps everybody. So you don't want to lock the door, but you got to be careful because it doesn't help anybody to bring in someone who's not going to be keeping the Torah. So we presume that it was sincere, but the person then went off the derech. A person born Jewish goes off the derech, so a person not born Jewish can also go off the derech. But what if they convert and the next day they're eating pork? So that already calls into question the whole process, right? So there already you can say, well, one second. I mean, it was all a farce. Like, what is that? There was nothing going on. So assuming they were told that you can't eat pork. See, if a convert is simply not told about a certain mitzvah, they never knew about it. They weren't told. So then the fact that they're not keeping that mitzvah certainly does not invalidate their gerus. They didn't know. But if they're told Jews don't eat pork, and the next day he's eating pork, well, so it doesn't. It certainly appears like it was not a good conversion. So,
is 6 months the time frame, or
I made up that number just okay. So we can, you know,
just checking.
Right. So it's going to be a gray area. It's going to be quite. There's a lot. That's why there's a lot of times we don't know, and we don't know. And the truth is, does it? How much does it matter? So it doesn't it matters to the person who converted, but if that person is happy with their status and they're, you know, and they're eating pork now, they're not really, right? What's really going to matter is marrying that person or marrying their children. That's where the question really comes up. That's why when inquiries are made about a shidduch and it turns out that there's a gerus in the family, a lot of investigation is asked for. Not because anybody's anything against converts. It's because you got to make sure that everything was done right, and that it was done properly.
But my question is, let's say somebody wants to convert and they find out that this based in has a 90% success rate and this one has a 10.
Yeah.
You know, the one with the 10 halachically might be just as valid.
Might be.
But right. If you're a convert, aren't you going to...
Most likely.
Hopefully go to the one that has more of
Most likely. Now, these kusim converted because of the lions. There is no question it was because of the lions. Had the lions not come, they would not have converted. There's no doubt it was because of the lions. But we paskin, even an insincere conversion works. So that touches off this debate of whether the kusim are geire emes or geire arayos. An insincere conversion works as long as there was a commitment, right? It can be insincere. I may be doing it because I want to marry this woman, but I am committed to keeping the Torah. But if I'm just, it's all smoke and mirrors. I just want to trick everybody into thinking that I'm Jewish so that I can marry this woman, but I don't really mean it. Well, then that doesn't work. So were the kusim simply pulling the wool over everybody's eyes just to appear as if they're Jewish? Or were they sincere, meaning it was for the wrong reasons, but they did make a commitment? So that is debated in the Gemara. Now, this pasuk that I pointed out to you, where it says...
So do we know who the three were that converted Based in
was? No, we don't know. And it may have been many batidinim. We don't know, you know. But the in Pasuk Lamed Beis 32, where it says Vayasu lahem miktzosam kohanei bamos, they made from them, from part of them, the word katza means edge or part, kohanim for the bamos. So the word miktzosam, this is part of the debate. The word miktzosam could mean from the edge, meaning from the lowest of society, meaning they weren't really worthy, they were not really Jews. Or it could mean, like the word katsin means a leader, that from the leaders, And those who say that it means that they really were Jewish, they understand this to mean that they were from the leaders. Were these actually Kohanim or not actually Kohanim? So that is part of the debate. Now, these Kusim they're there. They're here in Israel, and they're living in the place of the 10 tribes. That's what's happening. Meanwhile, in Malchus Yehuda, in the southern kingdom, Chizkiyahu is about to become king, and it's going to last for a good long time longer than the 10 tribes. So, eventually, though, the southern kingdom, Yehuda, is also going to go into Galus. That Nebuchadnezzar is going to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, take the Jews into Galus. The Shomronim remained in Israel. They were in Israel because they were put there by Sancheriv. Nebuchadnezzar had no reason to take them into Galus because they weren't Jewish. Or they weren't part of the Jewish people. Even if they were technically Jewish, they never assimilated into the Jewish people. They were always considered a separate group. So they remained there. 70 years after Nebuchadnezzar became king of Babel, or actually after the first time, after he conquered Nineveh, after he became powerful, which was 52 years after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, then, as we learned, when we learned the Sefer, we learned Daniel, we learned Ezra Nehemiah, we learned those Sfarim, we learned that the Jews were given permission by Koresh, who was the king of Persia, before the Purim story, to return to Eretz Yisrael and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. And they did. They returned. Most of the great ones returned at that time, including Nehemiah, including Mordechai, including Daniel. They all returned at that time. The notable one that it was missing was Ezra. Ezra did not return at that time. Those who returned laid the foundation of the Beis HaMikdash. But eventually, they were stopped. And the reason they were stopped is because the people living there sent messages back to Persia claiming that the Jews were planning a rebellion, which was false. But they got the work stopped. Who were the instigators that got this stopped?
The Kusim.
The Kusim living there, the Shomronim, were the ones who got the work stopped. They teamed up with some of the leaders that were there at the time. One of them, his name was Shimshai. Shimshai was one of the sons of Haman. And he was one of the leaders there at the time. And together they teamed up to stop the work. They successfully stopped the work. And then the Jews who had, I guess, made Aliyah, came back. That's why Daniel ends up back in Bavel. Nehemiah ends up back in Bavel, also in Paras in Persia, because they've now migrated a little bit further east, and they all end up back in the Gullus. 18 years later, a lot has happened, because now you have had the Purim story in the interim, complete with the Jews being threatened with annihilation, and V'nahafachu, and the Jews are saved. Mordechai is catapulted to greatness, Esther's in the palace, and the Jews finally are given authorization to go back and continue the building of the Beis HaMikdash. This time, Ezra leads everybody back. Ezra being, hands down, the greatest Talmud Chacham of his generation, and to the point where the Gemara says that had Moshe Rabbeinu not preceded him, Hashem would have given the Torah through Ezra. Ezra's hands down the biggest. There's nobody close to Ezra. And he leads the Jews back for the second Beis HaMikdash. And they do build it. When they are there, because of the constant opposition that they have from the Shomronim and the abhorrent behavior of the Shomronim, Ezra brings together a group of people. There's a formula for doing this. 300 men and 300 children and 300 shofars, a whole to-do. And they officially excommunicate the Shomronim. They put them in Cherem. Now, what does that mean? That means that it can officially not be interaction with the Shomronim. He makes it official that they are not to intermingle with the Jewish people. It's no longer a social thing. It is now official. It is legal that they are ostracized in the second Beis HaMikdash. So they're separated.
Why didn't Ezra come back the first time?
He didn't come back the first time because his Rebbe, Baruch ben Neriha, who was one of the Nevi'im, was still alive, but too old to travel. And Ezra did not want to leave his Rebbe because he was learning Torah with his Rebbe.
Did the lions stop after the Kosim converted?
Yes.
They did? Okay,
yeah.
So it worked.
So it worked, and even if you say that they were fake, it worked. Right? Which is really a proof to the one who says that it was real. Because otherwise, why did it stop? Okay. So Ezra segregates the Shomronim. There still is bad blood between the Jews and the Shomronim that goes on the entire second Beis HaMikdash. Later on, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Chulin that they discovered the Shomronim worshipping an idol of a Yonah, a Demus Yonah, a dove, on Har Gerizim, on the mountain of Gerizim, of the two mountains that the Jews were supposed to have the curses and the blessings on when they came to Israel. They found them worshipping an image of a dove on Har Gerizim. And they put them in Cherem, they excommunicated them. Tosfos asks the question, I thought they already were excommunicated in the time of Ezra. So Tosfos explains that if you argue that they were not really Jewish when they converted here with the lions, then when they were excommunicated, it didn't really mean anything because they weren't Jewish anyway. The excommunication was, you can't intermingle. Well, if they're not Jewish, you can't intermingle anyway. You can't marry into each other. So that cherem didn't really do anything. Later on, many of them converted again, or maybe for real, however you want to put it. And when they discovered that they were worshipping this dove on Har Gerizim, this is already after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, they put them in Cherem. And then in subsequent generations, over the next 100, 150 years, they ended up first decreeing that, well, actually I don't know what order it was in, but decreeing that their wine is not kosher, their bread is not kosher, their women are not marriageable to the men. Our women can't marry their men. They ended up essentially making a decree that they are not Jewish. Meaning, you have to treat them like they're not Jewish. Whether they are or aren't is immaterial. Because they have been acting so deplorably towards the Jewish people, and they are now officially worshipping this Avodah Zarah, they decreed once and for all that the Kusim are treated like non-Jews. And that is the default, that they are treated like non-Jews, whether they are or aren't. Now, at this point in time, so many years later, then it's unlikely that they're still Jewish. Or if they are, it's a very small strain, because with all the whoever they're marrying, whoever's involved, bringing in people, there's no conversions going on that are legal conversions, so at a certain point, they're not Jewish anymore. Or, if they are, they're likely mamzerim. They're illegitimate, because all the marriages and divorces, who knows what's happening over there. Interestingly, The Mishnah tells us a fascinating thing about Kusim. The Mishnah says, any mitzvah that the Kusim did take on as being real and important, harbe medaktikim ba yoser mi Yisrael. They are more careful with that mitzvah than the Jews are. Meaning a mitzvah that they became fixated on, that mitzvah, they do it 100%. Which leads to some very interesting discussions.
Which mitzvahs do we know?
So the Gemara says, one of the discussions over there is, can you eat the matzah of a kusi on Pesach? Very appropriate for today. We're heading towards Pesach. So can you eat the matzah of a kusi on Pesach? The Mishnah says, not only can you eat the matzah of a kusi on Pesach, you can even use it for your mitzvah Pesach night. It's considered to be shomor. It's considered to be l'shem matzah's mitzvah. Now, Tosas asked the question. I don't understand. I thought they said that they're... I said, yeah, it's like Pasakum and Bishalakum. You can't eat their food. So Tosas says what the Mishnah means, if it's your dough, it's your flour, it's in your house, the kusi is in your house making matzah, you can rely on the fact that the kusi did not allow it to become chametz. That's what it means.
But he can't be in your house because he's excommunicated.
Right. So that's a good question. But that's how Tosa says it. Tosa says that in
he's
your
like
house,
like an employee,
something like that. Right.
He could be a chef.
Right.
Okay.
Or housekeeper, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Right. So that person baked matzah in your house, then you can eat that matzah on Pesach. However, Tosa says, and this is supported in the Gemara and other places, you can only do it if you see the kusi eating the matzah on Pesach. Why? Because the kusim don't believe in lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, that you're not allowed to put a stumbling block in front of a blind man, which means you're not allowed to cause someone else to do an avera. They don't believe in that. That, they don't keep. They keep matzah, but they don't keep the rule that you're not allowed to make someone else do an avera. So the kusi doesn't mind tricking you into thinking that it's matzah when it's really chametz. That the kusi doesn't mind. But if the kusi, him or herself, actually eats from the matzah on Pesach, then you can also eat from that matzah on Pesach. That's what the Gemara says. Now, is that true today? I don't know if it's true today anymore. But that was true in the time of the Gemara because they kept the mitzvah of matzah with all its rules. That's what the Gemara says. There's a discussion in the Gemara. What if a kusi signs a document? Can we rely on the kusi's signature, on his edus, his testimony? Discussion about that as well. So there's very interesting, it's just a funny kind of dynamic that you have here with the kusim that emerges from this discussion. But the origin of those kusim is here. Now, one last point about the kusim is, the kusim are the shomronim, which as I mentioned, that the Christians call them the Samaritans. This is based on a famous passage from I don't know if I should say the name, but from the Christian Bible that involves a story, and the term Good Samaritan comes from there. Now,
not so good to the Jews.
Not good to the Jews at all. The story that is fabricated there is about, allegedly, is about a person on the road who was beaten and has nothing, and the Kohen walks by and doesn't help him, and the Levi walks by and doesn't help them, but then the Samaritan came by and helped him, right? Because it doesn't matter who the person is, you have to help a person who is in need. And that's the story. So because of that story, the term Good Samaritan has become associated with helping someone in need. Someone who can't help themselves, helping them. That's why you have, in the United States, in many places, many states, have a Good Samaritan law, which is there to protect a bystander who tries to help someone who is a victim or who is in a medical emergency, and the bystander, because they are not professional, actually hurts the person they're trying to help, but because they were really trying to help, the Good Samaritan law is there to help protect that person. Let's say a person performs CPR on somebody and ends up not doing a good job and possibly hurting the person. So since they were trying to do what was right, so the Good Samaritan law is there to protect them. But that term Good Samaritan comes from this story. So the problem, of course, is that the phrase Good Samaritan is in itself insulting to us. Because the whole story is there to try to
make
show
look bad.
Right, to make the Jews look bad and to show that we don't care about the downtrodden, etc. And it's obviously a fabricated story, and that's the whole point of it. So it's not a nice term for us. But you know, nobody remembers that, or nobody cares about that, and so that's the phrase that is used. But we Jews should not be using that term. The Samaritans, the Shomronim, the Kusim, are not good people. Were not good people, and they because of that they had to be put in cherem. And the whole source of that phrase comes from a source that we know is not Emes.
So I have two questions. One, Naomi didn't have a Beis Din when she converted Ruth.
She did.
Who was there?
We don't know. But she had to have had one.
But it doesn't say it in the text.
Right, I know
itself.
I know it doesn't say it. But you can't have Gerim without that.
Right, so that was problematic for me.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and the other thing is you later have the group who pretends that they came from afar, but they didn't. And they're the water bearers and everything in the base of Mikdash. Why weren't they excommunicated?
Right. So they were earlier. Then these of Yehoshua.
Right.
The Givonim.
They, right.
Yeah. So the Givonim come. We haven't learned Yehoshua in our group. But one day, Mr. Shem, we'll get to Yehoshua. So they tricked Yehoshua because they were from the Canaanim and they really should have either been killed or they would have had to leave, and they tried to stay. So they made it appear like they came from a faraway place, and they tricked Yehoshua. And so Yehoshua swore to them that he would not harm them. Then it turned out that they had tricked him. So he couldn't go against his oath. So that's...
Not to harm them and to excommunicate them are two different things.
So even though they were sneaky... But that doesn't mean that they acted badly, meaning they didn't do anything bad to the Jewish people. However, later on they are excommunicated. Later on what happens is, this we did learn about...
How is trickery not harmful?
Because trickery is deceitful, but they didn't do anything. They didn't hurt anybody. The Shomronim actually, they fought with us. They tried to get us. The Givonim were out to protect themselves. But later on in Sefer Shmuel, we learned that there was at the end of Sefer Shmuel, Shmuel Beis, there was a famine for 3 years, and when David HaMelech asked what the famine was for, he was told it was for two reasons. One is that we did not eulogize Shaul HaMelech properly, since he was killed, and it was a whole, we didn't do that properly. And two was because of the Givonim, because when Shaul had, when Doeg killed Nov Ir HaKohanim, the Givonim were made, as you pointed out, were made into water drawers and wood. They brought wood and water for the Kohanim. That was their job. That's what Yehoshua did. He made them into that job, which was menial labor. That's when he made them. That's when he made their job to be, since they had tricked him. So when Nov was killed out, they lost their livelihood, and they were very upset about that. And no one had ever, no one made it up to them. So because of that, this plague now, this famine happened for 3 years. The Gemara points out the famine was both for the honor of Shaul, because he wasn't eulogized properly, and because of something Shaul did wrong. The Gemara says that's perfectly fine. You have that many places where Hashem will be on both, you know, deal with both things at the same time. So David then went to try to mollify the Givonim, and he offered them whatever they would need in order to be mochel.
Not a good ask.
Right, in order to be mochel. And they refused, and the only thing they wanted was to kill several of Shaul's descendants. And they would not give in unless they were that some of Saul's descendants were executed. And in the end, that is what happened. That Shaul's descendants were executed, and the famine stopped. So David HaMelech said at that time, this is the famous statement, that the Jewish people have three characteristics. We are Rachmanim, we are merciful, we are Baishanim, that literally means we have shame, which means we have some self-respect, and we are Gomli Chasadim, we do kindness. This group, the Givonim, have shown that they don't have these characteristics, they've acted with cruelty, then they can't be part of the Jewish people. So the Givonim there were also ostracized at that point. And they could not, a Givoni cannot marry into the Jewish people from that point on. Okay, so that brings us to the end of Perek Yud Zayin, and that's the saga of the 10 tribes. But we're not done with Sancheriv. Sancheriv is slowly but surely conquering the entire known world, and the southern kingdom, Yehuda, is still independent. And Chizkiyahu is the king. Chizkiyahu, the great tzaddik. So now we're going to discuss that. So we're not going to go into, I want to leave this because it'll be 3 weeks till we get back to it. So we'll start with Perek Yud Ches next time. But Chizkiyahu is a whole story in and of itself. In the story of Chizkiyahu, we're going to have a showdown between him and Sancheriv. And as I told you, we're going to have to focus on Sancheriv as the person. He himself, we'll have to discuss also. We have Sancheriv, we have Chizkiyahu, we have Yeshayahu, who plays a significant role. He's actually mentioned here in Malachim, and we're going to have to use Divrei Hayamim as we have, but also Yeshayahu as we go through the next story. It'll take the story of Chizkiyahu and Sancheriv is going to take several weeks. It's a long discussion. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.